Stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be talking with Summit County Council Member Kim Carson. Later on, Park City Summit County Arts Council Executive Director Jocelyn Scudder and member of the Recreation Committee Peter Tamai discuss one of the items on your ballot, the reauthorization of the RAP tax. Centerville Basin Planning Commission Chairman Ryan Dickey will be on the phone with a recap of Tuesday's meeting, and the director of Park City Film, Katie Wang, will have details about a couple more weekends of outdoor Twilight Theater at the UOP, as well as some of the virtual screenings being offered, and an update on the reopening of the Jim Santee Auditorium for Art House Films. Stay tuned. In local news, the Hideout Town Council meeting last night did not make a decision to approve an annexation into Summit County. That is scheduled for a special meeting set for tonight. But Mayor Phil Rubin said that if the council says yes, they want to be prepared. KPCW's Rick Bruff reports that at the Tuesday work session, they reviewed the details of a draft master development agreement with developer Nate Brockbank.
The Hideout Council discussed an agreement for a project that Brockbank is now calling Silver Meadows. At Wednesday's meeting, the council will consider a vote on annexing some 350 acres owned by Mayflower Stifting in the Richardson Flat area. A second vote would authorize the mayor to enter into the MDA with Brockbank. The draft prepared by Brockbank and his attorney Bruce Baird includes some 600 residential units, including cottages, condos, and apartments. That would include 480 market-rate units and 120 units of affordable housing. Baird was asked how they settled on 600 units for the density.
And 600 is what's needed to drive the things that the city wants out of this, like all the dedications that the city wants, which were being donated now as opposed to dedicated for sale. Like schools are normally sold. They're not given. Town centers and police facilities are normally sold. They're not given. The town has asked for goodies, and goodies cost the need for the developer to make a profit pencil. That's why the number is what it is, because that's the number it takes to pencil the project.
The draft plan calls for 95,000 square feet of commercial. A major site would be a grocery store. Beyond that, no more than 25% of the commercial would consist of chain stores. The town center would include a 3-acre site that could be a location for a police or a fire station or a possible town hall. A site of 8.5 acres would be the possible site for a school. Council members also discussed how commercial development will be phased in conjunction with the residential. Since the development area is near Richardson Flat, another item concerns the oversight, testing, and possible remediation of any heavy metals. Attorney Baird said that Brockbank is taking on more legal exposure there than anyone. Another topic involves the road connections from the project. The town center is bisected by Richardson Flat Road, which connects at the east end to the Browns Canyon intersection and at the west end to Highway 248 near the entry to Park City. But Hideout Council Member Jerry Dwinell said he wants to make sure they have two roads that are planned to connect north to Highway 248. However, Baird and Brockbank said it's unfair to make them commit to those road connections. They say they can't control whether Summit County will allow the road lengths.
We don't control the ability of Summit County to allow the connection of that road. So you're swapping one gun at Nate's head, which is the annexation itself, to another gun, which is approval at the road. You simply just can't give Summit County a gun to shoot him because, to put it bluntly, Summit County has shown that they don't care about fairness and reasonableness, et cetera. And they can quote me in that in their next lawsuit.
Attorney Bruce Baird. Finally, one provision deals with the applicant's proposal for a hiking and biking chairlift that would connect from the town center up to the top of what they call Richardson Peak. The draft says that if both parties agree that the chairlift is not feasible or if a better public option can be found, Brockbank will contribute up to $400,000 for a plan acceptable to both sides. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
And as the Hideout Town Council was meeting last night to discuss this controversial annexation and master plan development agreement of property in Summit County, 4th District Court Judge Jennifer Brown was ordering the Hideout Town Council not to make a decision on the annexation until she makes a ruling later this afternoon whether that annexation violates the temporary injunction that she has already ordered. Following a 90-minute hearing yesterday on Summit County's order to show cause, Judge Brown said that she needed more time to consider the arguments before making her ruling that could determine the future of Hideout's annexation plans. During the hearing, Hideout attorney Robert Mansfield said Hideout has corrected all of the mistakes it made when it approved the first annexation resolution and pre-annexation agreement in July. Summit County, he says, doesn't have a right to object to the annexation now being considered. Hideout's annexation, he said, is being done under the law that was approved by the state legislature in special session, and that law does not repeal the opportunity that allows Hideout to move forward with its second annexation. This is a new and separate annexation, he said, which the judge ruled that they could do. Summit County, he says, has no cause of action. The action Hideout is taking with its second annexation resolution, he said, is proper. It does not violate the court's temporary injunction, and it is within the law. However, Summit County Attorney Jamie Bracken argued that the rescission of the first annexation resolution and pre-annexation agreement does not cure the problem. The fact that there has never been a time when she called this pre-cooked decision hasn't been in place. The second annexation effort, she says, is still tainted. It's the same property, it's the same town council, and just because the first resolution was rescinded, she says that does not change the fact that the entire effort started illegally behind closed doors. The Hideout Town Council purposely hid what they were doing from Summit County, Park City, Wasatch County, as well as the public. Moving forward with an annexation that was misrepresented to the state legislature, who has since made it very clear that allowing a municipality to annex property from another county was never the intent, she says, has not fixed the original problem. Saying that she needed more time to think, Judge Brown said that she would make her ruling this afternoon at 4 o'clock, just hours before the Hideout Town Council has noticed a meeting to possibly approve the annexation. In the meantime, she agreed to Summit County's request that an order be put into place after the Hideout Town Council not act on the annexation until after she makes that ruling. Well, the Summit County Council met yesterday, also sent a letter asking the town of Hideout to drop its plans to annex into Summit County. On the phone with Recap, I have Councilmember Kim Carson. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning, Leslie.
First, let's just start with the briefing from the Central Wasatch Commission yesterday. Councilmember Chris Robinson, also who chairs the Central Wasatch Commission. Some council members have been very skeptical of the CWC and plans to link over the mountain to Park City. Where do you stand on all of this?
Well, I don't really have a position on the link because we just haven't received much information on it. They have a gondola possibly connecting from the Brighton area over to the Park City area. That's one of their sub-alternatives. I think it's worth having them present that alternative and provide more information about what it would entail. My biggest concern is the environmental impact that that would have. But I think it's worth having the information out so our community has something to react to. I think our involvement in the CWC is definitely worth our time. We have a seat at the table, and while there's not a lot of new projects that would come our way, I think there's enhancements to existing projects like the Salt Lake City Park City Connect. They're talking about expanding that service and making more direct connections, for instance, to the airport, which I think, you know, right now it primarily serves workers in the University of Utah area and, of course, students. But there's really not a good way to get from up here to the airport using that service. And I think that would be a welcome addition. And then, of course, the BRT that we're already working on for 224. And then they discussed enhanced transit service between Quinns Junction and Park City. So I think all those are positive, and having it within a plan being presented by the CWC could, you know, open up opportunities for funding and grants.
The council also discussed RFP for a new trash contract. Your staff says that you likely won't see many bidders. How likely is it that they will want to handle food waste and bulk waste, glass, or these other opt-in items?
You know, that's really hard to say. That's the million-dollar question right now. The meeting last night was to discuss what would actually go into that request for proposals for our 2022 contract. And the goal is to meet the current services or meet the service level of our current contract. But that's just for a base comparison. So we need to be able to have that to compare the different vendors that may apply or submit an RFP. And then we're adding in these alternative proposals and encouraging a proposal for particularly these opt-in services, such as bulky items, being able to, for instance, put a couch out and have them come and pick it up for an additional fee, green waste, and then food waste, as you mentioned. I think food waste is an area that we can really focus in on. And also, this is our general, you know, trash collection contract. So if it doesn't turn out that we get a specific one for food waste, that doesn't, I believe, prohibit us from then looking at a different vendor that may just bid on food waste collection. We do have some local businesses that are involved, for instance, in food waste collection right now that you can pay on a separate contract basis.
Yeah. And then in terms of recycling, I mean, council members certainly commenting yesterday, the recycling rules keep changing. So how do we make this? I mean, and we also have, of course, tourists that come from other areas with different recycling rules.
Right. One area that we discussed was looking at our HOAs and our multifamily units. And what's difficult, especially in the Park City areas, that so many of those are used for, you know, tourists when they come and visit. So you have somebody different in those condos every week. So it's hard to educate people, but it doesn't mean we don't try. I think there's a lot that can be done. One thing we talked about last night was working directly with the recycler to identify products that we should try to limit our recycling to, that'll make it more valuable to them. And if we say, okay, we're just going to recycle these four main items. I mean, metal still has some value. Cardboard still has some value to it. And cardboard takes up a lot of room in the landfill. And maybe one or two of the plastics. And then just really focus on educating people that, you know, this is what we're recycling. But it's just really difficult when it is changing. And then the markets are so low right now.
Yeah.
You know, another solution that we're going to ask for proposals for is a waste to energy or a compost alternative. And in that case, you accept all the waste. There may be some particularly valuable items that you still try to recycle, but for the most part, everything is collected and then converted to energy.
The 2021 budget, what's your take? I mean, it shows less spending, of course, due to the pandemic impacts.
You know, I'm really pleased that first the effort of staff and employees in reducing the 2020 budget. We reduced it by almost 13%. And we heard last night that most departments are actually on target to spend less than that 13% reduction. So I just applaud them for the hard work that went into that. One of the ways we've been able to do that, though, is not filling positions. So we need to be careful that that doesn't reduce service levels in departments. And then there's been some key ones that we've filled, and we'll continue to look at that going into 2021. But, you know, I'm pleased with our initial look at this, and we'll spend the next 5 weeks, you know, talking about it department by department and each one's challenges and the goals that they have for next year.
Yeah. So what are the chances of a truth in taxation hearing next year?
You know, we haven't even had a single discussion on that. I think we have to, we committed that we would look at that every 4 to 5 years, and we did it last in 17. So I think it's important for us to have that discussion next year and see if we'd want to propose that for the 2022 budget. And I couldn't begin to tell you what that would look like right now. I know that our goals that we set out when we did the one back in 17 for the 18 budget have been successful. We've been able to build back up our fund balances in both the general fund and the municipal services fund. So those are now back within our target range. In fact, towards the upper end of that. And I can't, you know, that just brings a huge level of comfort going into this next year since there's so many unknowns still.
You're also briefed on mass vaccination planning as a health board member. Do members of the public talk to you about the idea that a vaccine won't generally be available until perhaps next summer?
Yes. I can't say I've had any citizens contact me about that. I think everybody's in touch with, you know, what's going on and reading and hearing information on various news sources. So we do hope by the end of this year to have some vaccines available for, you know, our first responders and highest risk individuals, our care providers, healthcare providers who are on the front lines. And then we'll go to another tier, you know, during the winter next year, depending on availability of vaccines. And then hopefully by July, we're working toward mass vaccinations in the community. There's a lot of work that goes, logistics that go into this. So hats off to the health department for the work that they're already, that they've been actually working on for over 3 months. In putting the necessary pieces in place. So hopefully when it gets time that we receive those, the plan is there. Everybody knows the part they play in it, and it can be an efficient, effective way to get these out to our residents.
Okay, I have just a few minutes left here, and I want to get to Hideout. Reportedly, okay. You and Council Chairman Doug Clyde have met with the Hideout Town Council in settlement talks. Can you characterize how those discussions have gone?
I think they've been very productive, and that's about all I can say about them because they are confidential meetings. Our goal was, number one, to build a relationship with them, and secondly, to talk about the challenges and the opportunities that surround the issues that they have right now. And so I would say from that, those two standpoints, it's been successful. I can't tell you how they're going to vote this afternoon. We have asked them to please vote no and allow a regional planning process to take place before they have a development agreement in place. I still think there's a lot of questions surrounding that development agreement. And it's kind of hard to say because, you know, we've seen it during the meeting.
So what do you do if Judge Brown rules this afternoon that Hideout can annex and the town council tonight votes to do so?
Well, we'll move forward. If they have requests of us, we'll, you know, meet our obligations. As far as regional planning, you know, we still have a lot to work around, work with as far as transportation is concerned. So I would say that any regional partner is invited to the table to discuss that area. As far as other regional planning for them, It's going to be up to them to reach out to the required service providers. There's a lot of questions around water and sewer service through JSSD. You know, if you take service from them and then you have water draining into another river drainage, there's issues there. So, you know, there's a lot of unanswered questions that they'll need to work through.
How do you respond to the developer's attorney, Bruce Baird's, comment that Hideout is getting regional cooperation because they're holding a gun at their heads, basically the threat of annexation here?
I found that incredibly offensive. In his meeting the other night, he used several references to guns, shooting people. I just can't imagine doing something like that, especially with everything that's going on nationwide right now. It was just very objectionable.
And why did
Go ahead.
Why did you think it was important that the county and Park City issue this joint letter condemning Baird?
Because it was so offensive, and it was done repeatedly throughout the meeting. He also used foul language throughout it, and it was just incredibly unprofessional.
Well, could he say in his defense that he wasn't actively threatening protesters, but rather those Zoom bombers, people who are actively sabotaging the public meetings?
Yeah, but there were other references besides that one reference. But he didn't clarify that either, Leslie. And there, from what I heard, he insinuated that those Zoom bombers and those that were protesting were all individuals from the neighboring area. And, you know, I don't know a single individual that went and protested and, you know, so I can't speak to that.
Yeah, there's
if he was actually there.
There's a phrase in the letter that I don't understand. I asked a colleague what they thought, and we had differing answers. So can you explain here, this statement basically says that Bruce Baird undoubtedly will attempt to deflect his hyperbole, resulting perhaps from on-air overindulgent during a live government meeting. What was meant by that phrase, that Baird is grandstanding because he had a live audience, or that he was overindulging with alcohol?
I'm not going to make an accusation of what he was doing. It was just, I just will say that listening to that meeting, it was incredibly, I felt, odd behavior and very inappropriate.
So we should read overindulgence as over-imbibing?
I would ask that you listen to the recording and make your own assumption.
Okay. Kim, I've got to leave it there. Anything else that you wanted to mention?
No. Well, I would like to mention that we did have a change within the state as far as the way that the health department will issue orders. They have now gone to what I feel is a better system of being data-driven to determine what level of risk individual counties have. We are now in the moderate level, and what that means is in statewide, gatherings of greater than 10 are restricted except under certain exceptions. And I would encourage everybody to go to utah.coronavirus.gov and look at those new order. It does mandate masks at least through October 29th. And we still have our mask order. We will continue to have our mask order in Summit County, which currently goes through the end of the year. It's just incredibly important right now with numbers surging that we wear masks, wash our hands frequently, and the social distancing is key. And I know Halloween is a very popular holiday up here, but please, I urge everybody to limit your numbers, if you want to get together with friends you know and trust, you know, if that's a risk you're willing to take, just make sure that you keep it to a limited number of people. We're really concerned about the effects of large gatherings and parties.
Okay. Kim, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Well, the Summit County Council held a public hearing yesterday on the 10-year reauthorization of the RAP tax. All of those who spoke at the hearing were from nonprofit organizations who depend on the RAP funding. No dissenters. In the studio, I have the executive director of the Park City Summit County Arts Council. On the phone with me, Peter Tamai. He's one of the members of the committee that decides how the taxes are collected. The taxes collected will be spent on recreation projects. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
So, good morning, Leslie.
Jocelyn, let's start with you, and just maybe you can talk about how important is the RAP tax for your organization as well as other cultural organizations.
Well, the RAP tax is a critical funding mechanism for many of our arts and culture, all of our arts and culture organizations. We have nearly 20 in our Summit County community, and it's one of those lifelines that especially, we heard it last night during the public hearing when Randy Barton and Brian Richards from Mountain Town Music spoke up and talked about the really industry-specific pain points that arts and culture organizations have experienced and suffered this year due to COVID-19, not being able to gather people, not being able to provide creative experiences for the community. But so in their various shutdowns and trying to pivot what their programming looks like, RAP tax really buttressed and fortified their budgets. It's something that has been in place since 2000, and we've seen such value brought to our community because that tax was passed in 2000, and for the last 20 years, we've seen nearly $20 million invested back into our community. And I think one of the biggest talking points when we talk about this tax, it's not, people's taxes aren't going to rise. This is a simple renewal of a tax that has been in place for 20 years, and it is a sales tax. It's 0.1% on every cent. So it's 1 cent on every $10, essentially. And it's a sales and use tax. And so what that ends up meaning for our community is it's mostly paid by visitors and tourists. And then that money that's put into these sales tax coffers, then it directly benefits our residents and really improves our quality of life. So it is a critical funding resource for our nonprofits in any year, let alone a year where we've really had a lot of challenges.
Yeah. So how has the Arts Council used RAP funding?
Well, so all arts, not, what's amazing about RAP is it's actually one of the only local government funding resources that's unrestricted. And this is very rare. If you're in the nonprofit sector, you probably know that a lot of times when you apply for grants, they can be project specific and they have to go specifically to, you know, supporting X, Y, and Z. Having an unrestricted grant is wonderful because you can put it towards programming, operating expenses, you can put it towards hiring staff. A lot of our RAP tax does support our staff at the Arts Council because it's one of the only unrestricted grants that we get. So it's been able to help us grow as an Arts Council. We used to be a one-person staff for a very long time. We are proudly now a staff of 2.5 plus some staffers at Crate PC, our pop-up on Main Street. And so I think that's one of the huge benefits of the RAP tax is it really helps these organizations support themselves and have the staffing to execute their mission, execute their programming, and enhance everything they do.
And Peter, that's not the case, though, for recreation projects, is it? And don't people have to come with a specific project in mind?
Absolutely, Leslie. The RAP tax for parks, rec, and open space are all directed to specific projects. And so each year we receive anywhere between probably 15 and 35 applications for discrete projects. And they can be really small projects where, you know, it's a couple park benches for a pocket park in Hennifer or, you know, or projects, you know, improvements to the rodeo grounds or an ice arena or, you know, basin or the underpasses underneath a couple of our freeways that have connected the trail network so beautifully throughout the basin and the county. So each project that comes before the rec side of that is a discrete project and a discrete request. And it's really exciting to see, you know, the individual applicants, whether they're rec districts or towns or, you know, community garden or whatever kind of organization, the kind of projects that they're using for these to enrich the open space and recreational opportunities that are available.
So for that dollar that's raised for every, I guess, $100 in sales taxes, how much goes to culture and how much goes to recreation?
Currently, well, that split, go ahead, Jocelyn.
Yeah, no, exactly. This is it's a split tax. So half of the funding goes to recreation and parks and half of the funding goes to arts and culture.
Okay. And that was changed when? I mean, at some point it seemed like recreation got less than.
So I think back in when it was first, and Peter, you may have more history on this, but when it was first passed, 60% of the tax went to arts and culture and 40% of the tax went to recreation and arts. And then when it was passed back in 2010, it was placed up to a 50-50 split. And that is something that's defined in state statute. So that is continued and will continue if it is reauthorized this year.
Okay. And there's nobody who's publicly dissented this, huh?
Not publicly. You know, I mean, we've had a couple of comments and mainly just inquiries when we have supporters writing, letters to the park record asking, you know, did RapTax fund this? Did RapTax fund that? And so if you do have questions and maybe you're questioning your position on RapTax, summitcounty.org has a great resource website right on their homepage that you can click on for more information about who has been funded, what projects have been funded. And then the Arts Council's page, pcscarts.org, also has a resource page that then links down to Summit County. So if you have questions, you can feel free to reach out to any of us, reach out to the Peter on the committee, or Ben Castro is the chair of the culture committee. But, for the most part, this is a really easy way, in my opinion, for community members to invest back into our nonprofits and into our amazing recreational facilities, our trail systems, and it enhances really everything we have to offer as a community and everything that we love to do here in our community.
And certainly one of the concerns was was whether or not money from the RapTax was used to do the murals on Main Street, which created a lot of controversy.
RapTax did not fund the racial equity mural project.
Peter, what did you want to add?
I just wanted to state that, you know, essentially, you know, I wanted to emphasize that, you know, we're talking about, 1/10 of 1% sales tax. So it's, you know, it's a penny on $10 purchase. It doesn't apply to food and groceries. And, you know, the only thing I've heard, when people hear tax, there's always this reaction, are my property taxes going up? And the answer to that is no. This is it's a sales tax, and it only applies to non-food, non-fuel items that are purchased in Summit County. So it's relatively painless, as Jocelyn said, and it's not a new tax. It's a tax that's been around for 20 years and has done, you know, a tremendous amount of good throughout the arts, culture, parks and rec area of our communities.
Yeah. Any idea how the vote's gone last 10 years ago?
So in 2010, it was a midterm election year, but it was favored 66% in favor. So a good margin. But we did notice when we went back to the voting records that only 11,000 voters showed up during the 2010 election. So, you know, that may skew those numbers a bit. I think we're going to have great, hopefully, voter turnout this year. Ballots are in the mail. People should have them in hand. And so we hope that we have majority support in favor of Proposition 21. Which is the RAP sales tax. And note that we are actually at the very bottom of the ballot. We are the last item. So if you can hold your patience and pay attention and pay attention to that very last item, please vote in favor of RAP tax Proposition 21.
Okay, I got to leave it there. You guys, thanks for coming in, Jocelyn.
Thanks,
Peter,
so much.
Thank you. The Snyderville Basin Planning Commission met Tuesday night. On the phone with the recap of the meeting, I have the chairman of the Planning Commission, Ryan Dickey. Good morning, Ryan.
Hey, good morning, Leslie.
Major conversation was about the Highland Flats development. First, where is this located?
This is located, it's two large parcels that make up a combined 40 acres off Highland Drive, sort of around the big curve. Another way to describe it, if you're traveling on 80 east and you get onto 40 and you're taking that big long curve around as you exit and you look to your right, there's that big open space. That's the parcel we're talking about.
Okay, and currently it's rural residential?
That's right. Currently rural residential, so one unit per 20 acres could be built there.
Okay, so basically two units.
Correct.
All right. Well, the facts are is that the applicant proposing 410 single-family and multifamily units. All of them would be rentals. 31% of the units would be affordable. The average median income about 61%. The project still over 69% open space. To the east would be a Catholic church parish. To the west, a horse pasture. So how does this get over the hurdle of the 2.3 section of the development code, which requires that no new entitlements are allowed unless an applicant can show a compelling reason?
Well, yes, that's one of a number of questions from the general plan, which prescribes that this is very low density or open space, and describes the Highland neighborhood planning area as, single family detached structures and with lots of traffic mitigation. So there's that. There's a rezone from rural residential to community commercial to get the density. And then there's policy 2.3, which as you say, the countervailing interest question and affordable housing has sort of become a little bit of a coin of the realm. This project does deliver a lot of affordable housing. 30%, it doesn't sound like a big number. I think probably the compelling part about it is that a quarter of that is 30% area median income or below. Another quarter is 50% area median income and below. That's really difficult affordable housing to get built, and they're doing it without tax credits. So, the affordable housing it would deliver is compelling, but there are a lot of other big questions about how much it offsets the community's interest in limiting growth.
So where's the access? You would need to drive down Highland Drive before you make that big turn?
It would be onto Highland Drive. I don't know exactly where the access is placed, but it does access onto Highland Drive. We've received a lot of public comment, written comment. We haven't had a public hearing yet, but concern about entering onto Highland Drive there and the potential for safety issues. So all that this is just a work session, but when it came down to an actual application, all of that would be really important to dig into.
Sure, and I guess what access, I'm guessing, is an issue as traffic and parking as well, huh?
There are a lot of parking spaces within the development, which means there's cars parked in the spaces and they're accessing Highland Drive. So traffic is a big issue. We talked the applicant talked about the addition of turn lanes and maybe a merge lane there, solutions for that. But there's no question it puts a lot of cars onto Highland Drive. And if we're talking about a large rental project, we're talking about people who go to work. So certainly we would expect that they'd be accessing Highland Drive at the peak periods, and that's another thing we talked about.
Yeah, and the fact that this property butts up to two major highways there is I guess a reason why affordable housing can be built there. What else could it be used for?
Well, there's the affordable component, but if 70% of it is market, that is people who are choosing to live in a spot that that is a little noisy, probably to say the least. But I think they think the applicant believes that there actually is sufficient demand for even the market rate housing here, and that's the market rate is what funds the affordable and makes the economics of the project work on the other side. So that's the vision.
Yeah. When do you think this will get to a public hearing?
Well, the applicant got a lot of feedback from us, and of course it's going to be up to the applicant. A work session, the whole idea is it's sort of not quite a trial balloon with the Planning Commission, but they haven't taken an application all the way. They're coming to us and saying, here's a vision we have, here's sort of a sketch of a site plan, and what do you think? What are the hurdles going to be here? What do we have to think about? And so they'll go back and it may change. it may come back in a different form or similar. I'm hearing a little bit of an echo there. So it's really hard to say when it would come to a public hearing. We've had a lot of written comment. The important thing to note, I know there's concern among always among residents that this seems to be moving forward and we haven't had a chance to comment on it yet. This would never go through without an extensive public process and public hearing. So that would certainly be something that has to take place before anything is approved.
Okay. Just want to also ask you your impressions of the joint meeting that you held with County Council last week.
I thought it was a great meeting. The objective was for us as a planning commission looking to the council for their leadership on, you know, what do you want us to be working on outside of, the application processing. And we really landed on, working on the general plan, which is now, it's going to be almost, 6 years old coming up this year. And so ready for a refresh, and to look at issues like policy 2.3 and, mixed use areas. And, I think revisiting in a public process, are we on the right track with the general plan that we're following today?
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Nope, that was a big one, and I'm sure there'll be more to come on it. So, thank you.
All right, Ryan Dickey is the chair of the Centerville Basin Planning Commission. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Joining me now on the phone with an update from Park City Film, I have Director Katie Wang. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Big news is that you're reopening Twilight Drive-In for two more weekends of film. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so we had a great response, as we talked about over the summer and early fall, to the Twilight Drive-In at the Utah Olympic Park, working with Dragonfly Media and, of course, the Utah Olympic Park to just put on a COVID-safe, really fun experience up there. And we heard loud and clear from folks that if we could come back, they'd like us to. So while the weather is still, fingers crossed, looking good, cooler temperatures are coming. So we do suggest people bring their puffy coats and blankets and get ready to cuddle up with their COVID clusters. But I think it would be a lot of fun. So we'll be back the 23rd and 24th and then the 30th and 31st because we really wanted to do something for Halloween this year. So we'll kick it all off on the 23rd with two ski film movie premieres, short films. One is Salute by Heinrich Harlot and the other is Skivas by Colleen Vallée-Baz. They're both celebrations of free skiing. Skivas, 100% female ski movie by the French free ski pro. So great way to kind of celebrate winter and all the things we love here in Park City on the slopes. And then on the 24th, we're doing a double feature. The first movie will be for the younger set, perhaps, or folks that love adventure films. And it's called Kubo and the Two Strings. And this film was nominated for two Academy Awards, including Best Animated Feature. And it's just a great story about a young boy who, armed with his magical instrument and talking monkey, battles gods and monsters to save his family and solve the mystery of his fallen father, who's the greatest samurai of all time. So great adventure tale there. And then that'll be followed by an evening screening or an 8:30 screening of Anchorman, which of course is the hilarious Will Ferrell parody of TV newsrooms in the 1970s. And there's a pretty funny showdown between the network and public news anchors that I think we can all appreciate. Then we're back on the 30th the next week, and we are back with the drive-in classic Grease. So please break out your poodle skirts and leather jackets and get ready to sing along to that great film. I was just testing it the other day, and it never fails to just be an amazing story. So I'm really excited to bring that back. And on the 31st, Halloween night, we'll have a costume parade and contest at 6 o'clock for the little ones. And that'll be followed by a screening of Monsters, Inc., which was nominated for 4 Academy Awards. And then we'll have a late night showing at 8:30 of Get Out, which is directed by Jordan Peele and premiered here at the 2017 Sundance Film Festival. It was also nominated for Academy Awards and won the Oscar for Best Original Screenplay. And if you have not seen this film or heard about it, it is a horror movie unlike any you've ever seen. And it's perfect, we think, for Park City's film-loving crowd on Halloween night. So just really excited to be coming back, being able to present films up at the UOP again. It's just a beautiful setting, and we're hoping that people will come out and join us.
So are there two screenings of Grease or just one?
Just one. Okay. So we're kind of mixing it up a little bit. The 23rd will be just the one screening. The 24th is a double feature. The 30th on Friday of Grease will be the one feature at 7 o'clock, and then the double feature on Halloween night.
Okay, so when you mention double feature, is it one ticket, both films, or no?
No, sorry. Each film is priced, each ticket is priced per film, except for the ski films because they're short films.
Right.
So the ski film ticket will be for one. So all the information is at parkcityfilm.org. And we still have, of course, our COVID restrictions in place. Masks, of course, are required. But we'll have popcorn and candy and invite people to come up and be socially distant and enjoy films together again, as we've done all summer. So,
all right. What's the latest on the reopening of the Santee Auditorium? I know that you took a survey of your members. Did they tell you they'd come back?
You know, it's mixed. And what's interesting is we did a survey in June, and then we did ask our members, you know, what were they thinking? And this, of course, was not a lot of movie theaters were open at the time. And certainly not a lot of art venues. Now we've got movie theaters are open around the country and around the globe, quite successfully, certainly internationally. They've been doing quite well. And now we have the symphony and the ballet opening up. So it's interesting. The split has not changed much. It's about half of our audience say that they are excited to come back. And as long as we can, you know, provide a COVID safe environment, which we think we can, you know, we've been working very hard with the city who owns the building, as well as the Summit County Health Department, to ensure that we're following, you know, the strictest protocols, kind of exceeding expectations there. There's a cinema safe protocol that the National Theater Owners Association, which is a trade group for movie theaters, has created that, of course, we're following. And then, you know, things like, you know, free sanitation, mask requirements, enhanced ventilation, social distancing. We're plotting out in the theater right now, blocking off seats so that when you come with your partner, your friends, you know, your COVID cluster, that you will be 6 feet distant from unrelated parties. And that's certainly something that is quite, you know, easy to do in the Jim Santee Auditorium because it's so large. So we do have the benefit of not only having a, you know, quite a large space for a movie theater, but we also have windows. I mean, that's kind of a thing I think people don't think about, that that's the original auditorium for that building when it was a high school. So you can literally open the windows to bring in fresh air, you know, make sure that it's clean and safe for people to come into. So we're doing a couple of test screenings to see what that looks like, and then we'll make some announcements here soon about, you know, what an opening will look like. But, you know, we're paying attention to our community and making sure that we're doing things in, you know, a very safe and controlled manner.
So no opening date is set?
Not yet.
Okay.
But we'll have announcements about that soon. And, you know, we do want to let people know that there are folks, you know, there was the 50% who said, yep, we're happy to come back in the next, you know, immediately or in the next month. And there are folks who said, you know what, we're more comfortable staying at home. And so it's really important to us to be able to serve all of our film-loving community members. So we are continuing with the virtual cinema. That is the plan for at least the next year through 2021. We're working to put in a new interface with a virtual cinema, so we'll have member pricing and make it a little easier to access the film. We've had some comments back that people are still, you know, having some challenges with casting the films to their TVs and accessing them in a more simple way. But, you know, we do have two virtual cinema films coming up this week, and one is a collection of short films from the New York International Children's Film Festival, and the other one's She is the Ocean, which is a documentary about nine women who are creating change and paving new ground and all connected by their love and connection and passion for the ocean. And, you know, even as we bring in the Twilight Cinema, we'll continue to bring in films to our virtual cinema. So we do want people to know that, you know, we are looking at multiple contact points for them and, you know, to let them know how much we appreciate their support. You know, we just heard about the wrap tax, and that's certainly something that we hope people will support, Proposition 21, that we've been, you know, very grateful for the funding we've received, and that's quite honestly how we're able to pivot and be creative with things like the Twilight Drive-In and with the virtual cinema. And then, of course, we have Live PC, Give PC coming up on November 6th, and would appreciate people's vote of support there, virtual high five, if you will. And then also thanks to Shop in Utah. We have memberships right now that are available for a 50% discount. So you can, you know, for a low barrier for entry, $27, you can become a member of Park City Film, get discounted tickets to our virtual cinema or in person. And, you know, we not only appreciate your support, we really need your support, as all arts organizations do during this challenging time. So, you know, the state and the community and the county, rather, have been, you know, quite supportive of us as arts organizations. The community as well has really stepped up. So just really appreciate people coming out, watching films. Please come to the Twilight Drive-In. It'll be a lot of fun. We're looking forward to some great films on the big screen again. So okay. parkcityfilm.org.
Thanks, Katie. It's Katie Wang is the director of Park City Film. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW.